This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Jared Bowen. What is art? It's an age-old question with endless answers. Some people might take a page out of Justice Stewart's playbook, saying they know art when they see it. Academics might argue art is everything from the manifestation of God to the external representation of emotions. Talk to an artist, though, and you might hear that art is simply about pure expression. It grows even murkier when the government gets involved, trying to determine what art should be publicly funded. These are big questions that playwright Lee Blessing takes on in his comedy Chesapeake, which is now playing at New Repertory Theater. Joining me in Studio 3 to talk about the show is star Georgia Lyman and New Rep's artistic director Jim Potosa. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jared.
So I'll give the brief 10-second encapsulation of the show for our listeners, which is that, Georgia, you play Kerr, a performance artist who will basically go to no end for her art, to the extent at which she finds herself in the middle of a national controversy for what she's done. I'm wondering how, and I can't really give away more than that because there are these great twists and turns, and it is a comedy, but how do you, as an artist, as an actor, relate to this performance artist that you're playing who really doesn't necessarily have boundaries?
Wow. I probably have a few more boundaries than Kerr does, but not many. I think it's our job as storytellers and artists to push boundaries and to push them for ourselves creatively and otherwise, just in terms of what you're comfortable with. And this play certainly does that for both myself as an actor and also, I think, for the audience member. We'll push your boundaries. Some people might feel uncomfortable. Some people might really have their minds blown. And I try to experience that for myself each night as well.
How do you characterize what her quest is? I mean, I gave the encapsulation, but how do you see what she's doing?
The story for me centers around transformation. And the transformative power of art and the lengths to which people are willing to go in order to use them. So in terms of what her journey is, I think Kerr takes on an artistic project thinking that it will change someone else and finds herself just as much changed as her project will allow.
Jim, we'll bring you in here. You're the artistic director at New Repertory Theater. I'm wondering, so you designed the season. I'm wondering if there was a specific reason why you decided to program Chesapeake now. Is there something happening? Is there something about this time that you thought, in this moment, we have to hear this play and this voice?
Absolutely. A year ago, when we were planning this season, we knew that early November was going to be a major presidential election happening, and it was not an accident that we programmed David Mamet's play Race in the weeks before that election and Lee Blessing's Chesapeake in the weeks after that election, the notion being that the American consciousness would somehow be involved with issues of race, and also that it would be impossible for issues of government funding of the arts to not be an issue in that presidential cycle. It was a guess. I don't think we thought Big Bird's life would be on the line.
Yeah, or that, I don't think any of us did.
Or that NEA being pushed to zero funding, which was an unheard-of position that the right took on this year. It made it particularly appropriate for Chesapeake to happen, not only because of the absurdity of those inherent positions in and of themselves, but also because Blessing, as you stated, it is a comedy. Mm-hmm. He is learning how to have this dialogue with an audience about a very serious topic, still keep his tongue in his cheek, which is a way to allow civility to occur within the conversation, and it actually becomes a pleasurable experience as you plumb the depths of a really touchy subject. And I think that's real artistry.
So give me a sense of, for instance, how prevalent is government funding for the arts right now? How much does New Repertory Theater rely on government funding?
Well, you know, government funding has never been as much of a source of revenue as it has been more of an imprimatur that stimulates other funding. New Rep has been the grateful beneficiary of New Rep of an NEA funding to support our classic repertory company, which produces classic plays and takes them out to school audiences at the high school level, collegiate level, and also to more remote cultural centers throughout New England. that amount might tend to be anywhere between $5,000 and $20,000 at max. It is important funding, but it is important funding not because of the dollars, but because of the scrutiny through which that application faces. And when you get an NEA grant, it means it has been vetted. You can take that history, take it to foundations, individual donors, corporate donors, and your institution has a greater sense of heft because of the vetting process.
And Georgia, you have an interesting take on this too, because you're a member of Orfeo Group, which is this great young theater company in Boston. And do you feel that you're in a climate where you rely on that funding, or when you guys are working, what are your methods? You're smiling here.
I am smiling. Orfeo has never received a grant of any kind from the government or any financial institution. On the fringe level, theater subsists by private donation. Personal donation, and whatever revenue we can raise, be it through ticket sales or merchandise. And, you know, we have our T-shirts and coffee mugs and whatnot. But the real, I mean, with Orfeo Group, we tried to put on as much free theater as possible. And part of that was because ticket sales, as any theater patron will tell you, are through the roof, and they really don't contribute to the... They're not a major factor in funding a show, ticket sales or not. So government funding for fringe theater is almost unheard of, and that is kind of part of the question of this play. Is this play was written in, what,
99?
When there was still some government funding for artists, and really, like, you know, Kerr is a performance artist, so I'm talking like put on a show wherever you want and live off of the grant while you do it. I don't personally know anybody who has ever received a grant like that personally. I'm sure it does still happen, but it's few and far between now, and most of the government grants I find are what Jim is talking about, as a sort of, it becomes a much needed and gratefully received social push for other people to take note of the work that you are doing.
I'm curious, is it something that you would even want? I mean, because as you see in the show, it comes with strings. You have to answer to people. You have to answer to senators like Thurm Pooley, who you also portray in the show, the Southern conservative senator who wants to take down art because of what Kerr is doing. So would you even want to get involved in that sort of network and nest?
There is an old adage that there is no such thing as bad publicity. And especially for smaller, younger audiences, I don't think that it would be harmful, I think, necessarily, depending on the artist. I think that some people would enjoy it as a way to continue to push boundaries and prove that art is worthwhile. Even failed art is better than no art at all, as Kerr says in the play. I think, yes. Are you asking, would you like money with strings? And any producer will say, yes. Just give us the money. It's an unfortunate tie-in.
Jim, I'm wondering what sort of the legacy of what happened in the 1980s is today, when there were all of these, there were the culture wars happening. And actually, this is a story also well told right now in the new ICA show all about the 1980s. But what is the legacy of the culture wars? And you point out in the program, in the sort of the foreword in explaining the play, that Lee Blessing even said that a lot of theater companies had to become more conservative. So is that one of the standing legacies of what happened? Have theaters sort of have to be more careful, have to be more cognizant of who they're alienating and what trouble they might be in?
I think actually all of what you just said is accurate, but I think the underlying cause, there was a seismic shift in what happened as a result of the artist losing the cultural wars of that period. And it really goes to the heart of what the case was for public financing of the arts when it initially happened in the early 60s, which had much more of a notion of the intrinsic value of art itself that was being funded. When that intrinsic value became politicized and therefore became something that politicians could say, we cannot give money to support this political message, it lost its sense of peer-reviewed meritocracy, which is how most of the awards were originally given, though there are abuses in that, of course. And it moved away from the merit of art to community standard. So when community standard took over, it's literally the same thing as saying the NEA will fund that which the community finds acceptable and therefore popular. So funding starts to pulse towards that which is safe in the sense that the community is not looking to be provoked, which is the kind of art that needs support. And you're more likely to get support for that which the community finds pleasurable or comforting. It is no small irony that in the during the George W. Bush administration, DeGioia, the then chair of the NEA's major NEA initiative, was the funding of productions of Shakespeare, the plays of William Shakespeare, in all parts of the United States. Why is the United States funding the plays of Shakespeare on the American stage? Of nothing against Shakespeare, but it just seems like a real slap in the face of every living, breathing American playwright.
We have a good one going currently.
And I don't think Shakespeare needs the help. But such are the kind of absurdities that happen in a highly politicized arts environment.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear from both of you. And again, we're talking to artistic director Jim Petosa of New Repertory Theater and Chesapeake star Georgia Lyman. I'm curious where both of you see boundaries being pushed in really productive, really entertaining and engaging ways right now. Georgia, I'm looking at you.
Locally?
Locally or nationally? I mean, where do you see it happening?
Locally, I think Charlestown Working Theater is doing some really good stuff and housing some really great companies, both international and local. I think they have a real fine-tuned sense of the extremities of what theater can be. I enjoy their production. They're a wonderful house to work in, and in the community, they're very supportive.
Because I have to fully admit, I haven't seen any of their work yet, but I understand they're telling stories in very different ways, and it's not necessarily big budget ways or
not
anything
at all.
Super extraordinary, but very just sort of clever ways.
Clever and deeply moving, and the theater companies that they work with also are doing the same thing. Orpheo Group worked there doing Love Song last year. Darren Evans in Theater on Fire is in residence there. But they also bring in people like Teatr Czar from Poland, Grotowski Workshop. They bring in, they have a partnership with Double Edge out in Western Massachusetts that has for, 20 years now been doing intensely physical, image-driven storytelling. I think that's part of what Jim is talking about, is that kind of art is not funded because most people will look at it and go, I don't know who Grotowski is and what are they doing? They're just running in circles for half an hour. But when you sit and watch and just allow yourself to become immersed in the experience, it's incredibly moving.
And of course, Jim, this is part of your job. You're constantly sifting through scripts. You're constantly looking at pieces of theater to figure out what to bring to New Rep. So what are you seeing right now?
I'm seeing it in the resilience of the playwriting community, which is really looking for a language to speak to 21st century issues. But where I see it the most and most movingly is in my other job as a director of the School of Theater at Boston University. The young people who are between the ages of 18 and 22, ready to make a commitment to a lifetime in the art, and most of what is driving
them... Which is paralleled with a lifetime as a waiter or...
Correct. That what they are, they're not looking for vainglorious lives of fame or celebrity. They're looking to participate in an art form that they believe will make a difference to the quality of life and the social dialogue going on within the country itself. They are quite high-minded. And I think as an artistic director, I want to make sure that there is a profession for them to enter after they go through their period of training, because otherwise it's just a sad folly to have them leave with high-minded principles and extremely profoundly developed aesthetics and enter into a world where they have no voice. That's what public financing for the arts needs to do, make sure that there is a voice, and so that a great society can be truly great and known to be great because of the greatness of its artists. That should be something in which we do not express cowardice based on content.
I want to shift gears a little bit. And Georgia, you have such a huge role on your shoulders. And I should point out, I am among them. People are just fawning over you in this role. You're just so fantastic. It's a one-woman show, essentially. I mean, you're doing this all yourself. It's nearly 2 hours. And I never asked this question, but I'm going to make the exception in this case. How do you do it? How do you remember all those
you
words?
You learn all the lines.
I know actors hate that question, but it's warranted here. It's so much material.
Well, you'll notice I do have the script on stage with me.
But I also noticed you barely looked at it.
I'm so glad you barely noticed that.
And that was early on. That was just a couple days into the show.
Yeah. we made the choice to have the script on stage with me for a variety of reasons. One, I was worried I may need it. And still occasionally will find myself just reminding myself where I am. Because, yes, it is 2 hours, and I don't feel any shame in expressing that. The other is that we chose to use it as a prop as well. And we use everything that we have there. The director, Doug Lockwood, and I had a lot of fun playing with using the sort of Spalding Gray mentality of it's just a guy at a desk telling stories, but then shaking that loose when things were exciting or needed to be done and turning them into other objects. And then returning them to their place. So it could just be a sort of home base. And in terms
of... It's also a message saying that all you need is a script and a chair and one great floor piece to make theater. It doesn't have to be. You don't have to have all the other trappings.
That's right. You ever seen a toddler on a living room rug? That's all you need. You just need to have stuff to play with, you know? And your imagination is big enough to... incite the audience into seeing that as well. And in terms of just learning the lines, practice, repetition, and figuring out what happens in the story and what goes where, and then finding these characters and making sure that I can keep all their voices in my head at the same time.
And again, without trying to give too much away, you variously play Kerr, of course, the great Southern Senator Thurm Pooley, and a dog at times. How does one get inspiration to play a dog? What does one study?
Dogs.
Yeah, do you have one?
I don't have a dog, actually. That was a moment of great hilarity in the early points of rehearsal when I said, I'm not even really fond of dogs, actually. I don't know. I just kind of let it come naturally. I usually consider myself a fairly physical actor, so I enjoyed just expressing that and then pulling it back a little bit so that it wasn't too much and finding, you know, where Thurm Pooley lives as opposed to where his wife lives in my own body, so that those subtle changes could be little mnemonics for the audience as well to know what was happening and follow along.
Jim, when you're casting a show like this, is it a different animal? I mean, is it so different to have somebody doing a one-person show? Do you have to look for a different type of actor as opposed to somebody who might be in Long Day's Journey and Tonight?
Well, you're looking for depth and range, but I think you're also looking for a particular kind of soul. And I know in the casting process for Chesapeake, what we were really facing was the notion of the moxie of a performance artist that mixes a kind of seductive arrogance with tremendous depth and yet charisma. You know, someone that you really like to spend time with, but someone who could kind of flip you off unexpectedly and that you'd always not be quite sure where you were, but you knew you wanted to stay longer. And Georgia...
Who's laughing right
is
next to you.
Because it's like...
That just about sums me up.
It does. And when you recognize that humanity coming into the room and you say, this humanity and this text will marry well, you know? And I think that's where we went, and the results are evident and obvious that it really does work.
Well, another interesting parallel here is Kerr in the show talks about her dad and sort of how that filtered in his appreciation of art filtered into her. So it's inherently genetic, which it might be for you as well. For people who don't realize, your dad is Will Lyman, a well-known actor and also very well-known to GBH audiences as a voice of Frontline. Is it genetic, do you think?
Absolutely not. I'm completely my own person. My dad had nothing to do with it. No, I'm kidding. Of course it is. I think it's... I mean, an artistic nature is nature and nurture. as well. And Kerr talks about her father not understanding art, but being willing to give it to her because he knows that it's important. And he doesn't know what it is, but it is important, and so you must do it. And that is where her life's passion began. I have a slightly different path because my father has a very deep understanding of what art is, and growing up with that will definitely influence you and inform many of your artistic choices. And I, there is a little bit of my dad in here. I've infused some of the, he hasn't seen it, so I'm not going to tell you, but there is a little bit of my father will sneak in to some of the characters that I play, just as there are influences from all over. But yeah, I think for my, in my case, I know it's genetic because I hear him in my head.
Is he going to see the show?
Yes. Yes. Actually, both my parents are coming tomorrow.
Well, that's nice.
Yes.
Will that make you nervous to have them there?
A little, but I also feel relatively good about this production. And my parents are both, having been trained in the theater and been performers, are supportive, while at the same time knowing how they can deliver thoughts on what can be more or what was unclear. And it's sort of we all feel that we can talk to each other about that, which
that's
helpful.
Interesting. When you in turn see your dad, can you be objective? Can you sit there as just an audience member, or are you looking at your dad knowing what he brings to a role, knowing what he might be internalizing?
I think there's probably always going to be a little bit of that, just as with anybody that you know very well, be it a coworker or a partner or a family member, you do see them and you see what they are bringing to the table. But for example, I saw my father in The Oil Thief at Boston Playwrights Theater several years ago, and it just blew the top of my head off because he was so natural and honest that I could actually see not only my father, he's playing an actor, and I could see not only my father, the actor, but also this character, the actor, and the two just blended seamlessly. And then watching him last year at New Rep doing Long Day's Journey into Night, both he and Lewis Wheeler, who I also know very well, I forgot that I was watching them, and I saw only this family. And it was just mind-blowing, because there were moments where I went, that poor man.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Before I let you both go, I want to ask you, we've been talking, sort of defending art in a large way through this discussion, but also I'm thinking, I don't know if either of you have read Camille Paglia's new book. She's sort of back with a vengeance, and she's written this great, great book of art. In fact, if people are looking for a Christmas present, this is the book. It's fantastic. She picks about 25, 30 art objects in, over the last few centuries as the paramount pieces of art, but she opens the book with this blistering essay, as only Camille Paglia can do, because that's what she does best. And it talks about how sort of people in ivory towers and art critics and other types in this age of Art Basel and whatnot have sort of now exalt pieces of art that shouldn't be exalted. You know, the Brooklyn Museum of Art piece with the Virgin Mary and the elephant dung on it. Have we gotten to a point at all, do you think, where we are, as she says, supporting second and third-rate artists just because they're provocative, just because they're exploitive and generating headlines?
I don't see why the art should be different from any other aspect of American society. I saw on CNN after a recent state dinner at the White House several months ago, and CNN brought on as experts on state dinners the Salahis, who, if you recall, were people who had broken into a state dinner several months before and ended up on some reality television about the housewives of D.C. Suddenly, those people, because of their notoriety, were being tapped as journalists to become specialists about a state dinner because they happened to break into one. If American society is going to treat how it transmits basic information about the news to such charlatans, why should the arts reflect a different standard? The problem is not an ivory-towered artist. The problem is in the basic foundations of American culture, which is formed from what will sell, what will make money, what will appeal to the lowest common denominator, and if we want to be bankrupt, this is a way to do it. Or we can read the words of John F. Kennedy inscribed and chiseled on the edifice of the Kennedy Center and be inspired to a level of art that suggests that the artist is, in fact, the servant to a great society. And we can measure ourselves by that notion and really become the people that we pretend to be.
Georgia, any qualms about where we're going? I mean, because you're still very much coming up in your career and have to look, just as I do, in reflecting what Jim just said in terms of where the media world is headed and what we've sort of twisted ourselves into. I mean, do you have any concerns going forward?
Constantly. Truthfully, absolutely. I see not only on a national media level, but, you know, locally, internationally, there's always concern. I think America especially has, the United States has a real problem with commercialism. I'm going to rephrase that not as a question. The United States has a real problem with commercialism. And I think that the more people are pandered to, the more Rome-like we become. But then again, we look back on Rome and we remember not only the great statues, but also the graffiti that still stands. There will be evidence of all of it. But hopefully, doing for myself, all I can really hope for is to do good pieces of theater. And I had two 17-year-old boys in the audience several nights ago who were just thrilled to be there. And I know that they walked out going, that was cool. Let's see some more. And that's really the only personal statement that I can make is to try and you know, tell good stories so that people remember them.
Well, I'm not a 17-year-old boy, but I left saying the same thing. So congratulations.
Thank you very much.
We have been talking about the role of art, about public funding for the arts, and how these two big issues are expressed in the comedy. I know we got heavy, but it is a comedy, yes. Chesapeake, which is on stage at New Repertory Theater through December 16th. There will also be a discussion, more discussion about the arts and government funding, a panel discussion at New Rep on December 12th at 7 p.m. To learn more about the show, visit newrep.org. I've been speaking with actor Georgia Lyman and New Rep's artistic director Jim Potosa. Thank you both for joining us. I'm Jared Bowen. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH.